Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Michael Chabon, who has a novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Earlier novels include Wonder Boys. Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is the story of two men who helped found the modern era of comic books. They're both fictional, but they appear to be based on two sets of partners, and I'd like to start from there. Maybe I'm missing something, and the two sets are Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, who wound up creating some of the Marvel Comics people, and Siegel and Shuster, who created Superman.
Actually, I don't think I really used either of them specifically. I was inspired to write about a partnership between two men in the comics business by reading an account of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster's partnership in their creation of Superman. But that was pretty much the extent of my inspiration by them, was just the idea of two guys, two young men, creating a superhero. That was pretty much the extent of it. And with Simon and Kirby, although I certainly was very well aware of them and their work, in a way they were just another team of guys who sort of provided the factual buttressing for my fictional construction of this team of Cavalier and Clay, and that there were these teams of guys who signed themselves with an ampersand and they worked together in the comics business, and therefore my team became more plausible because there were these other ones that actually existed.
The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is the title, and yet it struck me that a better title of the book might have been The Escapist. Did that cross your mind?
Yeah, but it sounded I rejected it partly because it sounded it was too good of a title almost. There's a term they use in Hollywood, on the nose, and it was too perfectly accurate in some way. I thought it would give away, it might give away too much about the thematics of the book, or sort of seem to solve all the problems of the book just in the title. And the other thing is there are at least two or three other novels called The Escapist already out there that have been published, so it seemed that, whereas there are very few novels called The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
This is your third novel, I believe, plus two volumes of short stories.
Yes.
And it strikes me as an observer that Michael Chabon has been building. I mean, there are many different paths that different novelists take, but here is a classic one. This is sort of the American dream, where each successive novel reaches a larger audience and a greater critical response.
Well, I guess I don't really focus a whole lot on that aspect of my writing. I do see a progression in the books themselves, and moving from my first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, which was a first-person, fairly autobiographical kind of work, through my second novel, which, though it was in the first person, incorporated more amounts of a greater amount of fictionalizing and more invention, let's say, and then to this novel, which is written in the third person and has multiple points of view and is also a period piece and is almost entirely fictional, in that there's very little sort of my own direct experience in the book. And that is the progression that I see happening. And in terms of the sort of the external things, I mean, I do feel like this book seems to have, it's gotten better reviews than anything I've written before. I am aware of that, and more consistently good reviews, whereas in earlier books I've gotten a mixture of good and bad.
Now, while this book is a novel, and as you say, it's more fictional than your earlier novels in the sense that it's less autobiographical, it also has a non-fiction feel to it in some ways, even to the point of there being little scholarly footnotes scattered through the book.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, in a sense, pass it off as a work of non-fiction, which, you know, is paradoxical because it is, like I said, it's the most purely fictional thing I've ever done, and yet at the same time, it does come kind of equipped with this whole factual apparatus, including footnotes. And the idea was to try to really, in a way, to confuse or knock off base a little readers to and it's worked because readers, unlike yourselves, who are very well, both of you are very well informed about, you know, pop culture and especially comic books, know more when I'm making something up and when I'm not. But the general reader, knowing very little about the history of comic books, I am finding is quite confused about just how real any of this is, and were there really such people as Cavalier and Clay, and is there a hero called the Escapist, and by blurring the lines and by including real life people in the book and by having my fictitious guys meet actual comic book creators of the time, I was trying to create to in a sense grant more reality to the world that I was writing about than it might otherwise have had.
The book is, as you say, very reality-based, and I noticed real people flitting across the pages. But somewhere stuck in there, you have a piece of fantasy that I'd like you to talk about why you included it, which is the ancient Jewish legend of the Golem.
Well, the Golem appeared very early on in the writing of this book in a very glancing way, and that is often the case with me with things that end up becoming important in a book often appear early and in a way that seems unimportant to me at first. And it was simply, I made this decision in a way that seemed very arbitrary to me at the time to have Joe Cavalier be a refugee, and specifically a refugee from Prague. And I really don't know why I made that decision. I've been to Prague, so maybe it just seemed like if I was going to have him come from someplace, it might as well be a place I'd actually been. So I said he was from Prague. Well, as soon as I thought of Prague, I immediately thought of the Golem of Prague. And so I figured Joe would probably be aware of the Golem, Golem legends, being a Jewish kid from Prague. So that when he comes to New York and he's asked to draw a superhero, having never seen a comic book, having no idea what a superhero is, he draws the Golem. And that was it. And that just seemed logical in a sense to me. But then I was interviewing Will Eisner, the great Will Eisner, creator of The Spirit and, you know, a pioneer in comics, still alive today, as you say, one of the few comic book creators who is cagey enough to hold on to the rights to his character of The Spirit. So he still earns a living off this character that he created back in the late 1930s or early 40s. And he was talking about, I asked him why he thought so many Jews went into the comic book field at this time in the late 1930s. And he gave me a very logical answer that involved the geography and the demographics of New York City at the time and the economics of the field of commercial art, where the upper tiers were not open to Jews. Generally, commercial art, advertising art were not open to Jews, so that if you wanted to make your living with a pencil, you had to do it in the lower tiers of the business, and that included comic books. But then he paused and he said, but, you know, I've always wondered whether there isn't something in the history of Jewish narrative, in the Jewish folk tradition, that didn't lend itself to the creation of the comic book superhero, because we have this history of impossible solutions to insoluble problems, which is the epigraph of my novel, such as the Golem. And I had just written that little bit about 2 days before where Joe draws the Golem in. And when he said that, it just clicked, all came together. And that's when I realized that there was going to be a role somehow or other in this book for the Golem.
While so many of the early comic book people were Jewish, none of their characters are.
That is a tantalizing fact, and I play with it, I think, in this novel. You know, it seems clear Jules Feiffer in the Great Comic Book
Heroes. The Great Comic Book Heroes, yeah.
He has that passage where he talks about how everybody knew the Spirit was Jewish. You could tell by his rumpled suit and his sort of harried urban air. And yes, his name might have been Danny Cole, but we all knew. And I think that in some, I mean, yes, just as was the case in every other popular medium of the time, in film and radio and so on, with maybe the exception of the Goldbergs on the radio, that Jews were completely absent from the landscape. And the fact is that many of the people who were sort of suppressing Jewish representation in the media were Jews themselves. And there was this whole kind of assimilationist impulse. And that's totally played out to me in the comic books themselves and in this whole idea of having a secret identity, of changing your name, and of changing it to something like Clark Kent or
yes.
Bruce Wayne or Jay Garrick or Billy Batson or Danny Cold. I mean, all these names sound like they were originally, you know, Blatstein, Billy Blatstein, or Bruce Wayne Winograd or something. And I tried to play with that, and I had this idea sort of simultaneously, unfortunately, with Jules Feiffer, who published an obituary for, I think, Jerry Siegel, right as I was working on this novel, where he talks about how Superman himself, the story of Superman, is a kind of an allegory of the immigrant experience, where that he comes from this other planet that is destroyed, and he's an orphan, and he comes to Earth, and he changes his name, and he becomes this all-American figure, that I had sort of hit on the same thing. It's not that subtle of an idea, I guess, once you start thinking about it. It's pretty obvious. And definitely... You know, Sammy himself, he's originally Samuel Clayman, and he changes his name to Sam Clay, as did so many of the comic book creators of the time, from Jack Kirby, who was Jacob Kurtzberg, Stanley Lieber became Stan Lee. That impulse was part of the real-life fabric of comic book business at the time, and I think it also got played out within the pages of the comic books themselves.
Speaking of alter egos, there's the other side of the alter ego in the character of Sammy, who's also gay.
Right.
The alter ego becomes, or the superhero, one of them becomes the closet.
Right, exactly. If I mean, I think, you know, none of this was really, I wasn't setting out to, certainly not to write a, you know, kind of an essay on allegories of immigration and latent homosexuality in the comic book. It's just once you start dealing with this material, it's so richly metaphorical that you can't help it. And so that with somebody like Sam, I mean, again, look at, with Superman, you have this idea of him, you know, in the phone booth changing his clothes. I mean, it's just such a scene, it's impossible to ignore the echoes of the closet with the phone booth and the whole skin tight costumes. And I mean, you know, this idea has been really overplayed in the recent Batman films from that Warner Brothers has put out, where the kind of gay element of the Batman look is really almost grossly overdone with the nipples and everything in the costumes. But it's there. It's a powerful part of the superhero myth. It's always been there. Dr. Wortham of The Seduction of the Innocent zeroed in on it very... with some accuracy and with some gross hyperbole in his book. And I think actually once he got done with it and with raising this whole question of the questionable relationship between Batman and Robin, or the lesbian tendencies of Wonder Woman and so on. Done with it, and once we sort of got rid of him, once Wortham could be sort of shown the door, the subject kind of lapsed again, and people were sort of just as, people especially in the comic book business, were just as happy to not be talking about that whole element of comic books. But, you know, it's there, it's important, but as Sammy Clay says, you know, what's much more important about the relationship between Batman and Robin is not that there's some kind of allegory there for you know, of pederasty, but that it's a father-son relationship. It's an idealized father-son relationship, that Batman is not is a father figure to Robin and to readers, and that fathers themselves to their sons often take on characteristics of superheroes, and that they seem both inordinately powerful and mysterious, inaccessible, concealing their identities from their sons.
But the Ward element also raised the comic book sales by 22%, Sammy said.
Oh, yeah, I just made that figure up. I have no idea whether that's true or not, although, I mean, it seemed to be a fairly taken for granted at a certain point that if you wanted a superhero character to do well, he needed a sidekick. I mean, I think a lot of that is actually writer's convenience. If it's just your hero, there's no one for him to talk to, and giving him a sidekick means that you have opportunity for dialogue and so on in situations where otherwise it would just be lots of thinking.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Chabon, whose novel is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
You mentioned Dr. Wortham, the famous or infamous Dr. Wortham. I noticed in your list of credits and acknowledgments in the back, I didn't find a line for Seduction of the Innocents.
Well, that's true. Although I did read it. I had a hard time finding a copy of it, actually. But I found a copy at the New York Historical Society Library, and I just sat down one day when I was in New York and read the whole book from cover to cover. It's a remarkable artifact. It's largely forgotten, except by comics readers and comics fans. But that moment where Wortham wrote that book and then there were these Senate subcommittee hearings, in retrospect, that was a kind of a prefiguring or a heralding of the things that are going on right now in cultural debate with people arguing about the role of the film, of movies and, you know, corrupting children or violence on television or violence in video games. And, I mean, that debate really got started. The debate over the debilitating effects of various kinds of media on kids' development began at that time in 1954.
In The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, there's a section dealing with those hearings. Senator Estes Kefauver, Democrat of Tennessee.
Yeah.
Talk about Senator Kefauver and those hearings. I noticed that you cite the appearance there of Bill Gaines.
Yeah. The comic book artists and writers and publishers were completely sold out by their newspaper comic strip brethren. Walt Kelly of Pogo and Milton Caniff of Steve Canyon and Terry and the Pirates showed up and testified that comic books were meretricious and comic books were lousy and rotten and they had nothing to do with them and they would never deign to touch their pinkies to a comic book and so on, which was completely a lie because, in fact, Walt Kelly did a lot of work for comic books. He created the whole sort of subgenre in comic books of funny animals, or at least helped to. And there were all kinds of great ironies there. And there was an actual pornographer, as far as I can tell, who was called to testify and completely covered himself in shame. Bill Gaines valiantly tried to defend what he was doing at EC, but ends up sounding kind of evasive and untrustworthy. And it was full of good stuff, but I ended up only being able to use a tiny fraction of it.
One of the things left out of the hearings, of course, is that comic books are an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, I think it's a subtext of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And the place it comes out, and I'd like you to talk about it, is when the characters of Cavalier and Clay, they've been doing The Escapist for a couple of years. They've made some money, not a lot, because most of the money has gone to the mm-hmm. publishers. They go to see a film, and that film is Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And once that film comes out, Joe Cavalier, the artist, changes, and he becomes a real artist.
Mm-hmm.
Did events like that happened, or is that completely out of the mind of Michael Chabon?
Well, no, actually, I mean, the reason Citizen Kane, or at least part of the reason Citizen Kane is in the book, is because in doing my research, I kept coming across references in the remembrances of creators of the time to the impact that seeing Citizen Kane had had on them, and that people like, I think, Jerry Robinson, who drew Batman for years, and a lot of other things too, said something about how they went to see Citizen Kane a dozen times when it came out. That the visual language of that film, which in a way was kind of, it summarized all of the expressionist cinema, like the German expressionist cinema that had come before it, but it laid it out in a very American kind of frame of reference. The visual language of that film was revolutionary for lots of people, for film people at the time, but also for comic book artists, and they kept mentioning it. So I thought, well, I have to get this in somehow. And it was made easier for me to forge that connection by the fact that Orson Welles was also a performing magician, a kind of an amateur performing magician, and he had ties to the magic community, strong ties to the magic community in New York City in the time. He knew Walter B. Gibson, who created The Shadow, who was also a magician, who was also a friend of Houdini's. And since I had my character of Joe Cavalier as an escape artist and a performing magician in New York City at this time, it was only natural that I thought that he and Orson Welles would know each other. And therefore, Citizen Kane just sort of, it just sort of grew out organically, grew out of the book without my having to impose it.
There was a very, very close relationship between various art forms, most specifically the ones I have in mind, are the pulp magazines and the comic books. Talk about that, if you would, and how these things fit together in the real world and in the mind of Michael Chabon.
I wanted to have at least one of my characters be coming to comic books, which at this point are a very new art form, with a full grounding in the literature that really preceded comics, which was the pulps. And again, it was not just from my doing research and reading histories of comic books and biographies of creators of the time, but from the interviews I conducted, talking to Gil Kane, Will Eisner, Stan Lee, you know, all of these guys were just voracious pulp readers, and it's just, it was like a necessary thing. I could not handle this material without addressing in some way or another the world, the sort of imaginative world that had immediately preceded the world that I was dealing with, which was the world of the pulps. And I have this character of George Deasy, who's the editor of Empire Comics, who is a veteran pulp writer. He's written, I forget the number now that I make up, but he's written, you know, 500 novels, and he has them. He's very embittered and has a very low opinion of his literary work, and as a kind of ironic, bitter joke on himself, he has all of his pulp novels that he's ever written bound in fine Morocco leather, and he has them on a shelf in his office with the titles stamped on them in gilt lettering, as a kind of a mockery of his own production. But yes, I mean, comics were very strongly rooted in the pulps. They were very much derived and imitative of the pulps. And Sammy's whole approach to them, at least initially, is a kind of pulp take on storytelling. I think it's with under pressure from Joe and from Joe's sort of artistic revolution that he undergoes, partly from seeing Citizen Kane, partly because he just has inherently an artistic temperament or a desire to express himself through what he's doing, that Sammy's ideas begin to change and get less beholden to the pulps over time. But it was pretty unusual for, getting back to the question of art in the comics, it was, in fact, it was almost unheard of at this time in the early 40s, let's say, for somebody working in comic books to look upon what he was doing, because they were almost entirely men at that point, as art. And the only person I'm really aware of who had those kind of feelings was Will Eisner, who almost from the beginning saw the artistic potential in comics, felt that what he was doing was a legitimate kind of art, was not apologetic about it. Whereas almost all of these other guys either were dying to get out of comics, wished they could get out of comics, or if they were content to stay in comics, never would have made any kind of claim to that there being art or having the potential to even be art. It didn't really begin to get talked about. The idea that comics could be art didn't really get to be talked about widely, I don't think, until the 1960s, and when people like Roy Lichtenstein were hanging giant comics panels on walls and saying this is art, that then some of the guys that had been doing this stuff for, you know, 25 years at that point said, hey, wait a second, I've been doing that for 25 years. You mean I'm an artist?
About two-thirds of the way through The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier Clay, there's a very unusual interlude that takes place in Antarctica,
mm-hmm.
featuring characters with named after baseball players, Gedman, Hauk, Mitchell, Stengel. Yeah, I caught that.
You're the first person who did.
What was the point of that interlude? What were you trying to do?
Well, that's World War II. I had to deal with World War II somehow. It was inescapable. And as soon as I began the novel, I started worrying about this problem of when I got to World War II, how I would deal with it. I did not want to write a war novel. I did not want to go to the battlefields of Europe or the islands of the Pacific. So many much more qualified writers had been there before me. I just felt like it was completely devoid of interest for readers and for myself, and I would just get lost there. So, but I started to worry about what I would do. And as I was getting closer to having to write about, to getting that I was approaching Pearl Harbor, let's say, in writing the novel, I ran across this brief reference somewhere or other, I don't even remember where now, to a mission that the United States Navy sent to Antarctica in early 1941, in what would have been the summer down there, to Antarctica to look into the possibility of establishing a foothold there, a military foothold there, in case one of the Axis powers, and specifically Germany, made some kind of move on that continent, because it did have some strategic importance. It was surrounded on all sides by these ripe whaling grounds, and whale oil was a strategically valuable resource, and so on. So there was this military interest there. It didn't pan out in real life. This mission came and went. The Germans never did. There are some conspiracy theorists who think that the Germans did establish a presence there, but that's unlikely. But I thought, well, what if it actually had happened, and what if there were a military presence? And as soon as I thought of that, I thought, that's it. I mean, I had finally found a theater of war that had not been written about before. And as soon as I got that idea, it began to resonate for me with lots of other things in the book, and that I had this theme of escape, of being imprisoned, and of having to get out. And that was going to happen if I sent Joe Cavalier down to Antarctica and he ended up being totally isolated and on his own. It was a feat of escape. It became a feat of escape. You also have the Superman story, which is kind of forming an underpinning of my story. And Superman had his Fortress of Solitude at the North Pole, but still it was a kind of a polar scene. And it just seemed like the perfect thing for me. And what I needed to do was to try to play out Joe, up to this point, Joe Cavalier has been entertaining increasingly more violent fantasies of revenge and of killing and trying to take revenge for what's been done to his family by the Nazis. And I thought it was an interesting challenge to me to stick him in a place where he had absolutely no opportunity of fulfilling these fantasies, and then giving him a chance to fulfill them, and trying to see what the effects of actually being granted the opportunity to take revenge would have on him afterward. You know, that became an important part of the story.
Michael Chabon, along with Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, there's a movie called Wonder Boys. It came out in around February or March of the year 2000, got very good reviews, and somehow never made any inroads.
No, tanked. It was one of these times when the critics really are almost unanimous in praising it, not entirely, but nearly so. And they almost, there was a missionizing impulse among a lot of the critics of saying, look, you people are always complaining that Hollywood's not making movies for grown-ups. Now here's a major Hollywood studio release that is for grown-ups, about grown-ups, with grown-up problems. It's not aimed at mall rats. It's not aimed at, you know, teenagers. It's aimed at you. Go see it. And nobody did.
One more question about Cavalier and Clay. Suppose you had a phone call from DC Comics or some other comic book company and said, we would really like to do a comic book called The Escapist. What would you say?
That would be so great. And actually, I've had a few emails from people at Marvel and DC asking me if I would ever be interested in writing for comics.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Chabon, whose latest novel is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff on Cover to Cover.